Okay, so this week we're continuing our theme on apologetics. We've looked at the reliability and historical reliability of the Bible, how we can trust the Bible. This week we look at the historicity of Jesus. You know, oftentimes we come across people where not even just the Bible, just the very existence that Jesus was a historic person is an objection. I mean, you hear that, you know, it's like Jesus, you know, people think that Jesus is just as historically truthful as the Tooth Fairy and Santa Claus. So, begin by, I think it's always good to look at how wrong approaches people have taken, you know, the worst way of trying to do this. And I think one of the worst ways of trying to come to the historicity of Jesus was modeled by what was called the Jesus Seminar. It was the late 80s, early 90s, a group of quote-unquote scholars, most of them actually not specialists in the New Testament field, not a lot of academic credibility. But they gathered, and they would have a voting system to go through about 500 statements and events that deal with Jesus and his life, so the miracles, his sayings, to determine whether they thought they were historically reliable or a later invention. And on the more high-profile passages, what they would do is they'd have multicolored beads. They would have red beads, which would indicate whether the voter was absolutely certain that Jesus said or did what was recorded in the passage. There was pink, which means they were pretty sure that Jesus probably said or did what was in the passage. A gray bead indicated that they believed that Jesus didn't say it, but it might contain his ideas. And a black bead indicated they were absolutely sure that it was a later addition added to the tradition. So they had a lot of statistical stuff going on. They'd have a confidence value that determined from the voting, using a weighted average, to determine whether something was true to what Jesus said or not. But there was a huge problem with how they weighted it. So let's say you have the mirror. The Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the poor in spirit. Let's say eight guys say that they're absolutely sure Jesus said it. Five guys drop in a pink bead because they're pretty sure that sounds like Jesus. Four drop in gray beads, and then 10 say, no, that couldn't have been Jesus. That doesn't sound historically accurate. And so the way they weighted the system, those 10 beads, because they're more than the 9 red, swayed the average so that in computing everything, they'd say, okay, yeah, Jesus didn't say, blessed are the poor in spirit, because of how they weighted the averages. A New Testament expert and a really good writer on most things, N.T. Wright knows the entire voting system and way of computing the results was entirely arbitrary and tended to support the assumptions that they came in. See, so often what happens in quote-unquote scholarship regarding the historicity of the Bible, the historicity of Jesus, is that they come in with their assumptions and then they tailor everything that they read and examine to fit their assumptions. And we can do that too. Confirmation bias doesn't run just one way. You know, if we have an assumption about how the world is or what's going on in the world, we're going to often interpret things that way. So rather than this being anything near a fair and scholarly examination of the text, the New Testament, N.T. Wright writes, but in several instances, a high percentage, sometimes a clear majority, voted either red or pink, i.e., either authentic or probably authentic, but the weighted average came out as gray because of the high proportion of black votes on the other side. A voting system like this, allied to a publicity machine that purports to tell America what Jesus really said, has nothing whatever to commend it. if even within the restricted group of the Jesus Seminar itself, a majority of scholars thinks that a saying is notably or certainly authentic, for a minority to vote black and so make the saying probably inauthentic simply cannot make sense. So he gets at something that I brought up time and time again. So much of what goes on in regards to the studies of Jesus that what we get either, you know, in the New York Times bestseller, the New York Times writes an article, ABC runs a holiday special around Christmas or Easter. All of this comes from a publicity machine. There's not a genuine desire to do genuine historic research. When a news channel or a channel like Discovery or History Channel puts on a documentary, it's not because they have a desire for serious scholarship. They're going to put together a documentary that people are going to watch, that's going to garner attention. The historicity of it, the scholarly excellence behind it, it comes far below their priorities. They want something that people are going to watch and talk about. And so that should make us very skeptical when we try to get our information from the publicity machine. And when our friends or our coworkers or a student at the school says, well, what about this ABC article about this? Now, we should keep in mind and guide them in thinking, okay, these people aren't writing for serious scholarship. These people are writing so that, people will look at it and so they can stir up a controversy. And so we can't begin with an assumption and an attempt to make the evidence fit it. This is how we should be with all of our lives. We shouldn't try to make things fit our assumptions. We should let facts and truths speak for themselves. We should understand that at times what we come with our prior assumptions, and we should not let our assumptions outweigh truth. And those who deny the historicity of Jesus begin with their assumptions. They begin with the assumption that we lived in a closed universe, so if there is a Jesus, he couldn't have performed the miracles that he performed. We'll look at the resurrection later, but they'll say, you know, people don't rise from the dead, so obviously Jesus couldn't have been resurrected. We'll get into it more, but there was a Jewish skeptic by the name of Pincus Lapid who did a serious study into the historicity of the resurrection, and he came to the conclusion, looking at all the material evidence and historic evidence, Jesus did rise from the dead. He didn't get saved, but came to the conclusion, okay, the evidence sways this way. So we begin looking at the evidence. So we've already established the case that we have a historically reliable Bible, much written within the lifespan of the eyewitnesses, so close to the events that it is highly suspect to argue that the stories and events are myth added long after the fact. You know, we have a short chain of custody there, really tightly within the occurrence of the events. And we know those are the best sources on the life of Jesus. Even a skeptic like Bart Ehrman agrees as much. But is the Bible all we have to argue for the historicity of Jesus? Four Gospels plus the epistles, is that all we have? Well, no. There's other literary evidence, other historical documents that give us an understanding of the historicity of Jesus. And, you know, we wish there were more, but you have to understand a major historic event. How many of you guys in history in high school or whatever learned about the Library of Alexandria? I mean, it was the greatest library in the ancient world. What happened to it? It burned up. See, it turns out, due to the delicate nature of books, they break down, tear up. I mean, the fact that we have as many manuscripts of the New Testament, the fact that any of these ancient books have been preserved, is a great thing. I mean, more often than not, ancient writings end up getting destroyed by time. One of the earliest and best historical evidences for the historicity of Jesus is written by Tacitus, who lived between 56 and 120 A.D., and he gives a history of the Roman Empire. In his annals, in his history, he writes of Nero and the fire in Rome. Now, for those of you that aren't aware, there was a major fire in Rome, and the Christians became the fall guys for it. And he writes of this: "Therefore, to squelch the rumor, Nero created scapegoats and subjected to the utmost refined tortures those whom the common people called Christians, hated for their abominable crimes. Their name comes from Christ, who, during the reign of Tiberius, had been executed by the procurator Pontius Pilate, suppressed for the moment. The deadly superstition broke out again, not only in Judea, the land which originated this evil, but also in the city of Rome, where all sorts of horrendous and shameful practices from every part of the world converge and are fervently captivated." Here, a non-believing Roman historian is writing, demonstrating a belief in the historicity of Jesus. Now, some have argued, well, how do we know that later Christian scribes did not alter this document to include a reference to Jesus? Well, I don't think any Christian is going to alter a document to describe Christians and describe Christianity as a deadly superstition. It's like nobody alters a document to make themselves look bad. I mean, if you're on trial and if you're going to tamper with the evidence, you're going to tamper with the evidence in such a way it's going to look better on you. If I were a Christian scribe trying to alter this, I'd say the Christians were these nice people who were innocently persecuted. You have some of the core beliefs. Jesus suffered under Pontius Pilate, crucified, buried. You have what you see in Acts, the quote-unquote superstition snuffed out and then spreads throughout the ancient world. Another source, Flavius Josephus, who was he was descended from the priestly family, ended up becoming a Roman general. He was part of the siege of Jerusalem in AD 70 that led to the destruction of the temple. He is one of the foremost historians of that period. In his Antiquity, he writes of the death of James, who is the brother of Christ. He writes in his Antiquities, "A bold man in his temper and very insolent, he was also of the sect of the Sadducees, who are very rigid in judging offenders above all the rest of the Jews. As we have already observed, when therefore Ananias was of this disposition, he thought he now had a proper opportunity to exercise authority. Festus was not dead, and Albinus was but upon the road, so he assembled the Sanhedrin of judges and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who is called Christ, whose name was James, and some others he delivered them to be stoned." And so here you have Josephus, the ancient Roman historian, just dropping in there in regards to the trial and martyrdom of James, the belief in the historic Jesus. We flash forward to Ignatius, who's also writing in the second century, who's linked with who's a bishop of Antioch. If you read Acts, Antioch is one of those important cities in regards to the New Testament. Peter ministered there, Paul ministered there. There's a strong apostolic connection to this city. And Ignatius writes in one of his epistles concerning Jesus Christ, who is of the race of David, who is of the son of Mary, who was truly born and ate and drank was truly persecuted under Pontius Pilate, and was truly crucified and died in the sight of those in heaven and on earth and those under the earth, who moreover was truly raised from the dead, his Father having raised him, who in like fashion will so raise us also who believe on him. Now, we might say, well, you know, Ignatius is probably just borrowing from the New Testament. You have to understand that the Gospels are still circulating, and not everyone at this point in history has access to them. The Bible hasn't been put together as we have it now. But even skeptic Bart Ehrman, who looked at time and time again, Bart Ehrman says of this testimony, Ignatius then provides us yet with another independent witness to the life of Jesus. Again, it should not be objected that he is writing too late to be of any value in our quest. He cannot be shown to have been relying on the Gospels. And he was bishop in Antioch, the city, where both Peter and Paul spent considerable time in the preceding generation, as Paul himself tells us in Galatians. His views can trace a lineage straight back to apostolic times. So Ehrman looks at that and says, okay, there's nothing in this that we can clearly tie to the Gospels. This is what historians would call a capital T tradition. The basic nutshell of the Gospel that was believed by all Christians everywhere. And so you have this independent witness, a bishop, who's ends up being martyred for Christ, affirming the historicity of Jesus in a city very closely identified with the apostles. So again, a short chain of transmission. You know, what would be called in judicial circles a chain of evidence. We know where he got his beliefs from. He's not copying and pasting out of the Gospels. He is drawing on the tradition that has been passed on through Peter and Paul. So, I mean, we've got strong literary evidence for the historicity of Jesus. There's also archaeological evidence. I don't think Caleb's watched The Office. There was an episode where one of the characters says, he asks, is there God? If not, what are all these churches for? Says, checkmate atheist. See, there's a strong archaeological evidence for a belief in the historicity of Jesus. Well, one of the richest sources of archaeological evidence for the historicity of Jesus is found in the Christian tombs, the catacombs. See, under the city of Rome and other Mediterranean cities, there are miles and miles of tombs. Many of them dating back to the late, or some of them dating back to the early and late first century. And one writer describes it, says, another early testimony to Jesus Christ and his followers is presented by the vast numbers of Christian tombs that have been discovered from the late first century and early second century. There are miles of tombs and other inscriptions referencing Jesus, referencing Scripture. There are portrayals of Jesus as the Good Shepherd. There are blessings carved on the tomb. That's one of the strong archaeological evidences demonstrating that Jesus was a historic person, that they understood and believed him to be a historic person, not simply a myth. I mean, one can't explain the history of the world without understanding that Jesus was a historic person. I mean, what happened with Christianity and how it transformed the world and how it grew exponentially, starting in the book of Acts, the life and testimony of the apostles, doesn't make sense apart from the fact that Jesus was a historic person. I mean, nobody's going to undergo the torture that Peter underwent and willingly be crucified upside down for their imaginary friend. And you might say, well, what if he was just that far gone mentally? What if he's that far crazy? Well, you're not going to get a majority of people to follow somebody that's crazy.
They're not going to get a following that changes the world. Now, people are that far crazy, they go the way of Jim Jones and go off into their commune and end up not ending well.
You know, oftentimes people say, well, you know, I like the morals of the New Testament. I just don't like all this made-up stuff.
Well, if all these miracles and the works of Christ, the apostles, are myth, then the morals of the New Testament are horrible. They're a bunch of lying charlatans.
As the saying goes, you can't have your cake and eat it too. So we have good historic grounds, good evidence, in addition to the New Testament, for believing who Jesus is and what he has done. In fact, it actually takes greater faith to believe that he did not exist. Any questions, comments? So the direction I'm thinking of going from here, so I've kind of laid the foundation, you know, the Bible and Jesus. I'm thinking about going through the different methods of apologetics, because there are different schools and different understandings of how we go about defending the faith. Would that be of interest to you guys? See, what we've been doing the past few weeks would fall in line with what is called an evidentialist approach to apologetics. You know, they examine the evidence and come to the most reasonable understanding of what happened. And then, you know, there's classical arguments that deal with arguments for the existence of God. There's presuppositional apologetics that looks at the fact that you know, everyone is actually borrowing from the Christian worldview, borrowing from a theistic biblical worldview to make life sense of life. You know, you can see that when somebody argues when somebody puts an ethical objection to God or the Bible, you know, when somebody wants to make value claims, you know, an atheist, somebody who doesn't believe that there is an intelligent creator behind creation can't make a value judgment about anything. You know, the naturalistic understanding of life, the world, that, you know, we're just this cosmic accident, as it were. You know, whether you argue for the Big Bang or as some cosmologists are arguing for an eternal universe, if there's no outside stand, if there is no outside rule giver, if there is no outside objective standard for good, then there's no grounds to argue good and evil on anything. You're left with entirely subjective positions of ethics. I mean, the atheist who denies an absolute creator God who's given absolute standards, their objections to something like the Holocaust amount to understanding whether you like chocolate or vanilla ice cream. It's just a matter of taste.
Not an atheist. That point in my class, and he was all about trying to give him evidence. When it came to the moral argument, he just believed that majority rules, whether or not there's actually a moral code, that because he didn't want to believe in God, he just was like, well, whatever the majority of people decide is right and wrong, that's what's going to create our laws. And I said, you know, it's just...
Then he asked him, it's like, what if the majority decides we're going to cook you and eat you for dinner?
Yeah.
It's like I'm reading the kid's missionary biography, John G. Patton. He was a missionary to what is now called Vanuatu, which was called the New Hebrides back then. And, you know, cannibalism was just a way of life for these people. It's like they even actually cannibalized missionaries on occasion. Yep. Which is strong evidence for the biblical worldview. You look at the world and, you know, the Judeo-Christian worldview that argues, you know, the problem with the world is people. We're the problem. Oh, we are sinners. Oh, we're sinful in our heart. It's like you adopt an evolutionary worldview and, you know, it doesn't matter what we do. Survival of the fittest. I mean, like even, you know, environmentalist. You know, if you have a Darwinian worldview, what's it matter if we eliminate most of the species? We will go, that's the direction we'll go, and that'll give us probably a couple months to dig in them and unfold. It's like up front, I will say, my professor for apologetics in undergrad, he's convinced me through an independent study I had with him that the best approach is what is called an integrationist approach. You know, you use them all. You know, different situations call for different tools. So I don't think that, you know, there's any point to be like, I'm going to be an evidentialist and never use these classical arguments for God. I'm not going to use presuppositionalism and look at the assumptions that they're using that are dependent upon. That actually, really, for them to hold up would require Christianity to be true as opposed to their belief that they're false. So we'll probably do an overview of evidentialism, then the classical argument, then presuppositionalism, and then show how you can use them all.